The headlines, the family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses says he was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical care during his detention. Muslims in many countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. And new data shows Europe's daily demand for Russian gas through Ukraine has hit its highest since the end of November ahead of the bloc's emergency energy talks. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Jahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses have told Press TV about his dire situation. They say Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical care. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over allegations of human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Khalq back in the 1980s. His family says that his arrest was illegal. They accuse the Swedish judicial system of issuing an arrest warrant for him without an independent investigation and based on untrue claims by some people. Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials did not allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as a political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. Muslims in over a dozen countries are celebrating Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Thousands of Palestinians marked the Eid with congregational prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque following weeks of bloody crackdown by the Israeli military in Al-Quds. The occasion was also marked by communal prayers elsewhere, including in Turkey, Yemen, North African nations, and most Persian Gulf countries. Tens of thousands of the faithful also gathered for prayers in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after the city's main mosque opened to the ritual for the first time since the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. Several countries, including Afghanistan and Mali, marked the Eid on Sunday. Muslims in other countries, including Iran and Iraq, are expected to mark the occasion on Tuesday. Journalist and researcher Sayed Mohsen Abbas says Eid al-Fitr is about much more than celebrating the end of the fasting month of Ramadan.
It's not a celebration that should be really, I think, taken simply as a joyous occasion in and of itself alone, because ultimately we know that on this day there are many oppressed around the world and there are people who are suffering at the same time, and it's a time when we have to share also, because in all the bounties that we receive from the divine, Muslims are encouraged not only to sort of spend on their own kith and kin, but also to the poor that perhaps surround them. Things like feeding others and serving others and being generous is equally as important as obviously creating happiness and joy for our own children and our own loved ones and family. There has to be a kind of a bigger purpose to it. And of course, nowhere more poignantly is that noted than, say, the oppressed people like the people in Palestine, for instance, today? I mean, how much will the Israelis be allowing them to live and peacefully and do those celebrations without the kind of persecution that's gone on? Yemen is the same. So my heart goes out on this Eid to those who celebrate Eid under famine conditions, under bombing and various other oppressive conditions, as well as those who have a life of ease and perhaps can those people should be sharing all the more with those who are suffering at this time.
Russian gas deliveries to Europe through Ukraine have hit a 5-month high despite tensions over the war in Ukraine. That is according data from a transmission system operator in Slovakia. The data shows that even Russian gas to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 showed an increase. In the meantime, EU energy ministers are holding an emergency meeting to discuss a Russian threat of halting natural gas exports unless European countries make their payments in rubles. The EU Commission says it is not aware of any company agreeing to comply with the Russian demand. A Hungarian official, however, says at least 10 EU countries are already buying Russian gas with rubles. This is while the bloc is reportedly planning a ban on Russian oil by the end of the year. Germany says it is ready to support the embargo. The bloc imports 40% of its natural gas and 26% of its crude from Russia. We talked about this matter in depth with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
I'll be joined by a couple of guests, Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels, also Greg Simons, researcher of the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. Now let's go to Jerome first. Jerome, EU, this is not the first time, I think, that the EU is holding such meetings, emergency or non-emergency, but they don't seem to be united. They are divided over this, like Germany, as you know. So what's the difference this time? What's the plan?
Well, Petros, the big difference this time is that this is a crisis, and there's no question about that, and it has the potential to develop into a much greater crisis. So, you know, the analysts I've been speaking to are saying that it's easy for countries like Poland and Bulgaria, for example, to take the high moral ground and to act tough and not pay any money to Russia since the 1st of April. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's the other bigger countries that have to pick up the pieces when some of these countries are acting tough. So, for example, I mean, Bulgaria is talking about taking in energy supplies from other countries. And obviously then everyone will be looking to Germany because, as you mentioned in the introduction, it's the powerhouse of the EU. And it seems to direct the bloc in all sorts of directions in terms of policy. Ultimately, it's the United States that seems to dictate the policy of the European Union. And that you could argue that's why we're in the situation we're in now, because of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, the U.S. is a net exporter of energy, so it's certainly not in the same situation as the European Union. This is going to put enormous pressure on citizens when we see inflation continue to rise and energy prices continue to rise. But again, in the situation for the likes of Berlin, you see there's a certain amount of sort of pragmatism coming into play here, and it looks like that Russia will be eventually paid in rubles by, you know, perhaps just paying in euro or dollars into a Russian bank, and it could be converted and so on. But the point is, if it does escalate, if it's a situation whereby the European Union, I mean, I've been speaking to just this morning senior officials inside the European Commission, and you have like 30,000 staff there working around the clock on many different policy issues in terms of implementing sanctions and so on. And the people I'm speaking to there this morning are saying, look, this is a complete mess. This is much more complicated than people could ever imagine. It's not just the case of deciding a policy of importing liquefied natural gas in tankers from around the world. That does not solve the issue. The reality is the pipes are in place. The cheap gas is coming from Russia. And we're in a situation that we could have an unprecedented energy crisis in the European Union, which would have a knock-on effect right across all elements of the economy, not just in terms of electricity prices or putting petrol in your car, but literally in every element of society. And that's the big concern. And that's why now we have at the very highest levels in governments, they're trying to decide how far can we push Russia without pushing too far.
Okay. Now, Greg, it is a complicated situation. Definitely, I think everybody agrees with that. Now, what alternative do Europeans have to Russian energy?
There are not many alternatives at this stage because, as has been noted, I mean, this is a cascading crisis which is more or less self-inflicted by the EU, which is not taking interests of the EU into account, but following the strategic imperatives of the US. Now, it is even before the war began, the US was already making the moves that it wanted to supply LNG to Europe. And this would be, of course, at a much greater cost. And there are no supply chains in place which would give a reliable supply and in sufficient quantity. So this is a rather foolish, self-inflicted home goal by the EU. And this is why you do have this fragmented approach by those who think they can afford to play these geo-economic games and those who know they cannot.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this news review. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent, joining me from Brussels. Greg Simons, researcher with the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies from Uppsala, with our contribution.
Iranian oil minister is in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, to reportedly boost energy cooperation between the two countries. According to U.S. media outlet Bloomberg, Javad Oji, with his delegation, arrived in Caracas on Saturday. The report has quoted informed sources as saying that Oji and his delegation visited a refinery complex with Astrobal Chavez, the head of the Venezuelan National Oil Company. The two sides are set to sign several agreements in the field of energy. Iran and Venezuela have been upping their cooperation as both are victims of unilateral U.S. sanctions. Venezuela imports condensate from Iran, which is highly important in the oil refining process. Tehran has also been providing refined products, spare parts and engineers to Caracas in order to boost its sanctions-hit oil industry. And Iran's president has called on Muslim countries to make every effort to stop inhumane Israeli attacks on Palestinians. Ebrahim Raisi said that the goal can be achieved through cooperation and tapping into international capacities. The Iranian president made the remarks in a phone call with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Raisi said Iran's policy is to, quote, meaningfully promote all-out ties with regional countries, particularly Turkey. For his part, the Turkish president expressed his keenness to travel to Tehran. Erdogan said that he would like to discuss regional and international developments, as well as the expansion of Tehran-Ankara ties during his visit. Palestinians voiced concern over what they see as a potentially devastating blow to the mission of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. The agency chief recently raised a proposal to delegate some services to other UN agencies. Palestinians are now warning of a plot to dismantle the body. Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya said the plan would violate the UN resolutions that set up UNRWA. The agency was established in 1949 to assist Palestinians who were forced from their homes by Israelis. It has faced a funding crunch for years, regularly falling tens of millions of dollars short of its stated needs. A human rights monitor says UNRWA is a reminder that the international community has a responsibility to solve the issue of Palestinian refugees. Earlier, we talked to Dawood Kutab, an award-winning Palestinian journalist, to get his insight on a proposal by the UN agency for Palestinian refugees to delegate some services to other UN bodies.
The timing of this and statements are very worrisome because it comes on the eve of the renewal of the mandate of UNRWA. And so there is a lot of suspicion that it's not a mistake or a misstatement. Well, UNRWA has been a very important element to the refugee issue and to the right of return. And their mandate is very clear. It's very separate from all other UN agencies. And I think attempts to outsource some of its activities without clear guidelines and that this is part of UNRWA's mandate is very worrisome. And I think there are reasons why people are worried about it.
The Israeli spyware Pegasus is in controversy again. Spain says it has detected the malware in the mobile phones of Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez and Defense Minister Margarita Robles. The minister for the presidency said the phones of the two top executives were infected in mid-2021. The official added that the government is certain about external involvement, but did not specify the place of its origin. The Justice Ministry has been asked to launch an investigation. The new revelation comes just weeks after the leader of Catalonia accused the central government of spying on the region using Pegasus following a failed 2017 referendum there. The rights group said then reported that phones of dozens of pro-independence Catalan figures were infected with the spyware and blamed it on the authorities in Madrid. The Pegasus malware was made by an Israeli firm. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Prophet's job. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Teaching and training means providing conditions for thriving and growing of talents and capacities in a creature. Principally, the aim of education is to construct humans. Therefore, the ultimate goal of the divine prophets was to educate mankind. They were raised by God to guide human beings towards perfection in a bid to take them to eternal happiness in afterlife. The prophets played the role of a gardener. In view of this, teachers are the followers of prophets if they guide their students correctly. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said, The first teacher is God, the Exalted, who takes people out of darkness into light and, by prophets and revelation, invites people to luminosity, perfection, love, and affection. After him, it is the prophets who promote the same divine school. Their job is also teaching, and they are the teachers of humans. Their job is to train humans so that he ascends from the status of animals and reaches the status of humanity. And after them, it is the teachers who are among humans. Teachers' job is the same job of Allah and the same job of prophets. Teaching is a very great job, an important job in the Islamic culture. The Noble Quran says in verse 32 of Surah Ma'idah, "Whoever saves a life is as though he had saved all mankind." Although the verse appears to speak about physical and material life, it also implies spiritual life. In other words, saving an individual from deviation and misguidance is in fact giving him or her life. Once a man came to the fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, and complained about the murderer of his father. He told the Imam that he intended to retaliate and kill the man. Imam Sajjad asked him, "Hasn't this man rendered any service to you so that you take blood money instead of killing him?" The man told the Imam that he had been his teacher for several days. Thus, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, said, "What are you saying? The value of teaching and guiding is more than blood and retaliation." Therefore, the man renounced retaliation. Teacher is the tool for learning and acquisition of knowledge. He or she is the one who causes individuals' intellect to grow. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "Indeed, Allah, the angels and the inhabitants of earth, even the ants in its home and the fish in the sea, greet teachers who teach good things to people." May 2nd has been called Teachers' Day in Iran. The naming of this day dates back to 43 years ago, when one of the great and inexhaustible teachers of this country was assassinated by the agent of terrorist groups affiliated to the U.S. and Israeli regime. The teacher was the world-known professor and great philosopher of the 20th century, Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari. Martyr Mutahhari was born in 1919 in Fariman City, located some 75 kilometers southeast of Mashhad. Having finished his basic studies in his hometown, he left for Mashhad to continue his education in the seminary of Mashhad. In 1927, he left for Qom to complete his Islamic studies in spite of the tyrant Reza Khan's tough fight against ulema and seminaries. During his 25-year stay in Qom, Ayatollah Mutahhari attended the classes of Grand Ayatollah Hussein Borujerdi, Imam Khomeini, and Allama Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai. In 1952, he left Qom for Tehran, although he had catapulted to fame as one of the great teachers and even future hopes of Qom Seminary. The great professor of Islamic sciences, Martyr Mutahhari, started writing of books and delivering constructive speeches in various fields of Islamic and social sciences. In 1955, he held the first session of interpretation of the Quran for university students. Very soon, the young generation was absorbed to his speeches, and the incorrect view on Islam was remarkably changed through his profound but simple speeches and classes. Ayatollah Mutahhari writes, "Experience shows that whenever religion is separated from ethics, it is ethics that falls behind. None of the irreligious ethical school has been successful. For sure, religion is necessary for human ethics, at least as a support. The more religion and belief have been undermined, the more human ethics have declined. That's why we should consider extraordinary value for belief, at least as a support for ethics, if not the only guarantee for implementing it." From 1946, Martyr Ayatollah Mutahhari authored valuable books in different fields of philosophy, social sciences, ethics, Islamic jurisprudence, Islamic history, education, and so on. More than 70 works were published from him. The most important feature of these works is that they focus on daily issues of society and answer many ambiguities and questions that were frequently asked by youth and families. His books and speeches were highly welcomed by university students and professors and intellectuals. Some of his works were published during his life, while others were published after his martyrdom. 43 years after the martyrdom of this great teacher of the 20th century, his name and fame has transcended countries and continents, and the scores of his books have been translated into several languages. This great teacher had said before his martyrdom, "If I am to lose my life in the way of preventing perversion in Islam, let it be so, as this is the best kind of death."
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The economy of Palestine, the land of Palestine, is being choked due to the Israeli occupation. And when COVID-19 hit, it was not kind to either. Israel's economy nosedived and is having a hard time getting back on its feet. if only the Palestinian suffocation was eased and Palestine was given a chance to prosper. The economy of Palestine and Israel, the subject of this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, Israeli economy was hit bad by COVID-19, 2.4% contraction. GDP increase for 2022 predicted, but the businesses are reporting losses. Why is there such a contradiction there? Then, taking a look at Palestine's economy, it continues to suffocate due to the Israeli siege. COVID-19 also has had a major negative impact. The UN saying that piecemeal approach is not efficient when it comes to analyzing and approaching the Palestinian economy. And finally, Israeli occupation in terms of what it has done. It has actually damaged the economic standing of Israel, so much so that even Israelis are fleeing Israel. Israel, an apartheid regime, consequential for the Israeli economy.
It is reported that Israel's economy has rebounded strongly from the COVID pandemic. The Bank of Israel optimistically predicted that the Israeli gross domestic product would grow 5% in 2022. The economy did register an 8.2% growth last year and is on track to reach 5.5% for the year 2022. Yet, this is called a COVID-19 bounce back, which is not a sign of sustained economic growth. Let's not forget the COVID-19 pandemic caused a 2.4% contraction in Israel's economy in 2020. It was the first time that the Israeli economy, which grew 3.4% in 2019, shrank since the year 2002. And Israel is again in the grips of an Omicron wave. Some industries are hit hard, like tourism. The job market, however, has bounced back far more quickly than economists had expected. Last April, the Bank of Israel warned that consumer prices would climb faster than what was expected.
The economy of Israel has its downfalls like many economies around the world, yet it falls pale to the amount the economy receives due to the political repercussions of the occupation, while at the same time the occupation preventing the advancement of the Palestinian economy. Now here are some of the online views on this. First of all, did you know that Israel actually did not have a budget until very recently? Israel's central bank urged to meet the looming budget deadline, says this entry. This was a result of a prolonged political stalemate. No budget had been ratified in more than 3.5 years. Israel has since been running with a prorated version of the 2019 budget, something economists say was hindering growth. And it was only in November of 2021, after more than 3 years, Israel finally had a budget. Dr. Alex Komen, an economic expert at Tel Aviv University, actually broke down the milestone event.
Hallelujah. We've had 3.5 years without a budget, which means that money was handed out in something that was called boxes. Whenever there was a problem, there was a specific donation, and which means that the public had no way of criticizing or crystallizing an opinion about whether expenses were right or wrong or whatever.
So how Israel was actually making payouts or conducting a ledger is beyond anyone's accounting imagination. Now, Israel is facing a dire economic fate of another kind. The cabinet of Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is on the verge of collapse. This comes after the Arab-Israeli party threatened to leave the ruling coalition over recent clashes that happened in Al-Quds. Now, forget the hype about Israel being a miracle, blooming cutting-edge economy, as it's been described. Israel exists and prevails due to huge subsidies from the U.S. taxpayer. Israel would collapse in a nanosecond if these subsidies were withdrawn. Well, here is one example of the subsidy that was mentioned, courtesy of the U.S. Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the world. They actually offer their citizens complete health care coverage paid for by the U.S. tax dollars, while Palestinians die on a daily basis because they are unable to access health care in the occupied territories, much less pay for it. If you can believe that. All right, joining us for this segment of the Q&A is Hindi Khoury, a former Minister of Affairs for Al-Quds. Hindi Khoury, welcome. Taking a look at Israel's economy, the OECD and Dun & Bradstreet actually have said Israel's economy has rebounded strongly. It's actually performing better than the global average. But at the same time, we're looking at complaints that are made by business owners that they had seen a 50% drop in their revenue. I mean, we're seeing quite a bit of a divergence here in terms of what's being said.
Well, it would look like there is a divergence because Israel has, I think, been restructuring the economy to emphasize more the technology sector. Technology and the security sector has been gaining very, very strong grounds in the Israeli economy and has been leading growth. Truly, the situation has been bad for everybody, including small business, especially small businesses. But Israel's economy is doing very well. It's very strong and very, very sustainable. Now, there is a controversy regarding the statistics, economic statistics, regarding Israel as a member of OECD, because the poverty, the average for poverty in OECD countries is about 11%. In Israel, it's 23%. And this, the poverty is actually among Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship and some Orthodox religious Jews. And there is the controversy is there, is that what is Israel? In which borders Israel is defined? We know the borders are not defined. And while it controls the whole of historic Palestine, including the Palestinian population in the occupied territories, so a total of Palestinian population about 7 or 7.5 million, with 8 million Jewish Israelis. So again, the world has given Israel a free ride on how it introduces itself, how it defines itself, using ambiguity in these definitions. If it was to include, for example, all the Palestinians in the occupied territories, this is the area that it controls, then certainly the statistics will be way different, because the income per capita in the Palestinian territories is about $3,000, while in Israel it's $42,000. I mean, this is just one indicator.
It's time now for our Info News section, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first news item is on China. China's economy actually grew 4% in the final quarter of 2021. Now, that expanded it to 8.1% for year-on-year. That's pretty good, although it's higher than the 3.6% that was predicted for the growth. The Q4 figure, at the same time, is the weakest growth that the country has seen in a year and a half. So we have to wait and see how things will progress in China, especially with the fact that they are experiencing another Omicron wave. Next to Germany, and a look at the economy there, it faces a recession if the war in Ukraine actually spurs the energy ban. Now, Germany's central bank is estimating that it's going to hit the GDP output by about 5%, so a negative 5% hit there. Possibly. And an embargo on Russian coal, oil, and gas is going to lead to restrictions on power providers and industry, which are examples of why a recession is a strong possibility in that country. Moving on to the dollar, standing another hit to it, this one coming from Israel. Israel is adding the Chinese yuan to its reserves. Now, the central bank is reshuffling forex holdings, reducing the dollar and euro exposure. Israel's reasoning, we need to look at the need to earn a return on the reserves that will cover the cost of the liability. Folks, the U.S.'s best friend Israel is saying the dollar is a liability. That's big. And our final story in the U.S., a rising tally of lonely deaths on the streets. More than ever, it has become deadly to be homeless in America, especially for men in their 50s and in their 60s. They are dying in record numbers in places like Los Angeles and California. Now, it's quite ironic because this is while the U.S. has aided a little less than $4 billion to Ukraine in military aid, and that's just in the Biden presidency. So you could take that and chew on that a little bit and digest that. Well, those were the stories that we thought were important to cover for our InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The occupation of the Palestinian land has brought nothing but economic misery for Palestinians, all the while costing Palestinians hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. And that is why this is the topic of our in-depth section. Well, in order to get an idea of the economic impact on the Palestinian economy, we need to take a look at how Palestine has been divided, even though Palestinians argue against this since it is their land. They've been divided into three areas, areas A, B, and C. Area A is under full Palestinian civil and security control, as it's called. Area B is a combination of Palestinian control and joint Israeli-Palestinian control. And Area C is under Israeli control. Area C, by the way, is where the bulk of the economic activity actually happens. Now, it's time to actually get a better idea of how Palestinians, as I just alluded there, have been robbed of their land throughout the decades. In the year 1974, as an example, in terms of what Palestine was, then you move on to the UN partition plan of 1947. It's pretty obvious how Israel has been forcing thousands of Palestinians off their land, occupying and illegally using it to create settlements. And as you move on through the years, those are the 1967 lines. The area in green is the Palestinian control, well, Palestinian land, and then it slowly decreases until you get to present-day Israel, which Palestinian is in the green, and look how much land they have, so much less than what Israel has. And that was Trump's plan, by the way, in terms of the division that it wanted to have for Palestinians and Israel. Again, Israel, which is in the white there, on Palestinian land again, has a majority appropriated to it. Now comes the economic impact of the occupation. This is something that is obviously very important. We broke it down into the following categories. General economic growth, $1.1 billion lost to the Palestinian economy again. Dead Sea Minerals, $918 million. Stones, another example, $241 million. Construction, $239 million. Telecommunications, tourism added to that. And then you come up with a grand total of $3.4 billion. Now, it's very hard to obviously get figures out of the occupied territories in terms of the Palestinian economy. So the figures and the categories that we chose, respectively, are average medians. So you're looking at about a loss of $3.4 billion that has happened as a loss for the Palestinian economy. And that is not counting the Gaza Strip. Our final look on the Palestinian economy needs to include the impact of COVID-19. That has obviously had a devastating effect, as if the Palestinian economy was not doing bad enough. UN report has actually stated in 2020 the Palestinian economy contracted around 10 to 12%. That's one of the largest annual contractions since the Palestinian Authority was established back in 1994. So the major hit that Palestinians took. That includes things like 150,000 Palestinians losing their jobs and similarly large negative impacts which are expected from the present lockdown, which is still happening. So obviously the contraction there is quite major. Let's try to get an idea about an analysis on this. Rejoining us for this segment is David Miller. David Miller is a broadcaster and academic, and he's a former professor of political sociology at the University of Bristol. David Miller, welcome. The Palestinian economy has been strangulated, no surprise there, based on the way that the occupation has exercised itself, looking at things like illegal settlement activities, also the confiscation of Palestinian land, destruction of property, etc. And, of course, you're looking at the agriculture, how it's not being given the opportunity for it to grow based on, for example, the seizure of water. With unemployment rates at record highs, how can Palestinians actually be optimistic about their future?
Well, Palestine cannot be optimistic about the future if we're talking about the status quo, if we're talking about the continued pressure on the Palestinian economy from the occupation and from the attacks on individuals and organizations inside the territories whose livelihoods are wrecked by settlers who operate completely lawlessly under the protection of the Israel Defense Forces. So the Palestinian economy such as it is, will suffer from more and more pressure from above, from the Israeli government, from below, from the Israeli settlers, and indeed supported by the IDF. And that will drive, doesn't everyone know this? That will drive more and more people into the arms of a united, resurgent resistance, because people have got nothing else left.
All right, indeed. Well, Hindi Khoury, the former Minister of Affairs for Al-Quds, rejoins us here to give us her thoughts on this. Hindi Khoury, looking at the Palestinian economy, again, it's really unbelievable that they've even been able to sustain themselves and actually make a living. There's so many different violations that have led to their economy being strangled, and of course the occupation is at the heart of it. Things like minerals, the Dead Sea, mines, non-renewable natural resources, not being able to for them to reap the benefits of that. And of course, unemployment at record highs. What do Palestinians have to look forward to in the future?
I prefer not to speak in the language of optimism and pessimism, because it depends on what we do and what others do, you know, what actions and decisions are being made. If ongoing trends continue, the prospects are very bad, I think, and maybe even disastrous. We have no local economy, and this is due for a prolonged, of course, occupation, but also prolonged unemployment, continuing drop in real value of income, increased dependence on foreign aid, Israeli controls most resources, and even Palestinian decision in many ways. We have a depleted middle class. The education sector suffers. I think it's not adapting enough to new realities and new technology demands. Purchasing power is not only income is dropping, but purchasing power is also dropping. And we have major structural problems. We have defined ourselves in the Basic Law as a free market economy, and where are we from freedom? And we have absolutely no control over the mobility of capital and labor.
The Palestinian economy was stagnant, and the socioeconomic situation was already difficult prior to the breakout of COVID-19. This was attributed to restrictions by Israel on trade movements and access, recurrent hostilities, and falling aid inflows. Despite small increase in economic growth in the first half of 2021, due to the easing of the COVID-19 containment measures, economic activity remained below its pre-COVID-19 levels, and overall growth was nearly at 3% for the year 2021. The occupied West Bank experienced a better economic recovery, but the Gazan economy contracted due to Israel's 2021 war on the Gaza Strip and the regime's restrictions and embargo on the coastal enclave. In 2021, unemployment in Gaza reached 50.2%. Chronic electricity shortages and lack of access to clean water supplies were also impacting the economy and disrupting people's daily lives.
واحنا خايفين اصلا على شهر رمضان يعني شهر انه الانسان بزيد فيه موضوع الطبيخ والاكل اكثر من الايام المعتاده وهيك فاحنا عم نطلع على الاحتياجات الاساسيه كلها ارتفعت مثل الدجاج الزيوت السكر الرز الامور والطحين.
It's time to have a look at the economy in the occupied territories, particularly since this is a special edition of Economic Divide. We will look at different stories to have a glimpse into both the Israeli and Palestinian economies. The title of the first piece is Tel Aviv Residents Living in Overdraft in the World's Priciest City. This is Tel Aviv. It's marked by expensive high-rises, busy highways, and also construction activity. But Tel Aviv is known for a disease that plagues many economies, and it's called inequality. Described as one of the most expensive places to live in, many Israelis can't afford to reside here. From food to clothing, prices are astronomical.
And I just visited my daughter, and I can buy anything in Manhattan, in Chelsea, or the Upper West Side for quarter of the price, which is ridiculous. I go to the supermarket and I don't believe it, the differences of prices, from vegetables to fish to everything, to toilet paper.
Time to see what Palestinians experience in their own motherland. Keep in mind that this land is theirs, occupied by Israel, and this is the type of worry they have to deal with. This is the main thoroughfare through the Wadi al-Jouz area, close to Al-Quds' old city. This is lined by mechanic workshops, but the Palestinian business owners in occupied Al-Quds are worried they will be forced to shut down their shops by Israeli authorities over plans to build a vast high-tech hub in their neighborhood. Remember the Bahrain conference? It was part of the so-called deal of the century proposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump, which, like him, failed and joined the dustbin of history. Palestinians were offered economic rewards if they accepted Israel, but many Palestinians declined that offer. Here are boxes of unsold biscuits piled up in a West Bank warehouse, a sign of the tough economic times faced by Palestinians, yet who are determined not to be wooed by Washington's economic pledges. The Palestinian owner of the West Bank warehouse refused to give in to the U.S. offer, neatly packaged in the Bahrain conference. And our final piece goes to Palestinian businessman and billionaire Munib Al-Masri. Here he is, walking near a fountain outside his mansion Beit al-Palestine in Nablus. And this is how he feels about the way Israel has dealt with Palestine.
The Jewish state means we don't have anything. During Balfour 1917, he called us a non-Jewish community. We have the right to go to the mosque and the church and to rule ourselves by municipality, but we have no political right whatsoever.
That does it for my section. I hope what we compiled for you could give you an idea about Palestine, which Israel calls its own. One day, it will get liberated.
The story of Palestine and its occupation has entered a new phase, the new phase of world recognition on a massive scale. Israelis are leaving Israel due to a lack of political will of Israel to solve the Palestinian issue. Israel needs to make a choice. That choice is to give back the land of Palestine, which it will never do. Meanwhile, the status quo cannot remain. Surely the Palestinians' resolve and resistance will overcome the Israeli apartheid regime. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thanks so much for being with us. Your questions and comments are always welcome. Do send them to us. For me, Kavit Ahwai, and the team, it's goodbye until the next program.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.